Honestly Unbalanced.
Welcome to episode 106 of Honestly Unbalanced, where we chat to people that have tried to make your life a little bit better. If you're struggling to achieve your goals and wondering how to be a little bit more productive and effective, then this episode is for you. We're chatting to Adrianne Adami, who's a well-being coach, author, and host of the Power Hour podcast that has now had more than 4 million downloads. And on the podcast, she chats about well-being, productivity, and entrepreneurship with some amazing guests. She's a brand advisor specializing in well-being, technology, and innovation, and has delivered workshops and keynotes for some ridiculously big brands like Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Range Rover. She's the epitome of a digital entrepreneur and was named as a top 25 black entrepreneurs to watch in 2023 by HSBC. She's also an endurance runner and mother. In this episode, we chat about what's stopping you from achieving your goals and why it's important perhaps to focus more on one goal per season of your life than lots of lesser ones simultaneously. We ask about whether daily activities actually contribute to our happiness, and if they don't, what to do about it. We talk about implementing a power hour each day and treating it as a gift to oneself rather than a burden. We talk about creating life on your own terms while still being considerate to friends and family. We talk about the value of avoiding treating productivity as an end in itself and the difference between motivation and discipline. Before we begin, I want to talk about your feet. Your feet are really complex parts of the body. The main way of us kind of interacting with the surfaces, of course, that we walk on and indeed the world around us. And yet we numb that sensation, we numb the muscles of the feet by wearing really thick-soled shoes, walking on artificially flat surfaces. In short, our feet have kind of gone to sleep a little bit. Now, you can wake them up via specific drills, maybe via yoga, but also you can wear Vivo Barefoot. Vivo Barefoot are super wide, do nothing to compress your feet, and their super thin, amazingly engineered soles allow us to really feel the surfaces we're walking on. If you want stronger feet, Vivo Barefoot are where it's at. Pretty much all I wear. I wear their snow boots, I wear their trail shoes, I wear their indoor trainers, and actually our little boy, that's pretty much all he wears as well. Code ADAMHUSLERVB, all caps, ADAMHUSLERVB, will get you 10% off those shoes. And if you want an amazing surface to practice your yoga on when you're not wearing shoes, Lifeform are without doubt the best yoga mats. I've used them long before I was an ambassador for them. So almost a decade, I think I've used Lifeform. They're a super ethical company. They do so much for the yoga world and beyond. And you can get 10% off any Lifeform with code HUSLER10, HUSLER10. And if they ever have a sale on, this code will get you even more off that sale. Might not get 10%, but it might get an extra 5% off. And last thing, it's very rare that Holly and I actually run a retreat together where we combine our yoga, our breath work, and sound healing magic. But we have one in June in Dorset. Incredible food, incredible location. There's ice baths, there's sauna, beautiful landscape. We're really pulling out all the stops for this one. If you fancy joining, head to adamhustler.com/Dorset to get all the details and get £100 off if you quote honestly and balanced in the booking email. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Honestly Unbalanced.
What gets in the way of people actually trying to meet their goals? Like, everyone has an excuse. Everyone loves to follow the route of least resistance. So what are the blocks that are stopping people from like just taking ownership and getting on with the things they know they want to do but aren't?
Gosh, that is a great place to start. I think it's different for everyone, but I think there's probably some common, common errors, I suppose, that people maybe have around, you know, goal setting and what stops them, as you said, from achieving their goals. I think for some people, it is not knowing what the goal is. So clarity. And I often talk, you know, when I talk to people about how to set goals, how to set meaningful goals, how to achieve goals, the first thing is clarity and really specific clarity. You can't just say, for example, if someone says to me, okay, my goal this year is to earn more money. How much more? 10% more? double? Do you have a number in mind? How are you going to, you know, what is the goal? And then you obviously, you know, once you know exactly what the goal is, how are you going to achieve the goal? Who could potentially help you achieve the goal? What are the barriers and blockers that could, you know, trip you up on the way to achieving that goal? And can you preempt them? You know, if someone's goal says, I want to get fit this year. That's my goal. That's not a goal. You know, do you mean you want to improve your strength?
It's a vague direction.
Do you want to improve endurance? Do you want to, improve your strength? Do you want to master crow pose? Like, what do you mean get fit? So I think the first thing that often I think, can stop people achieving a goal is that they don't really know what it is. It's just this vague, you know, something over there. And so then firstly, you don't really have the step-by-step process to do it. But then secondly, you don't really know. You don't have any kind of measurable parameters. So how do you know if you've achieved it or missed it? If it's just kind of get fit, what does that mean? Mm. So I think the first one is clarity. Got to have clarity, got to get specific and really specific. The more specific you can be, I want 20 bullet points at least about the goal. Then I would say, and this is quite a big one, and so bear with me. I often think that when people don't achieve a goal, it isn't because the goal was too big or too audacious or they weren't talented enough or successful enough or anything like that or motivated enough. It's often because of the pursuit of lesser goals. So as you said about the path of least resistance, if you've got one big scary goal, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the book Essentialism by Greg McKeown.
Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant book. He talks a lot about this kind of, if you're going towards one thing, you know, pursuit of one thing with 100% of your energy, attention and focus, you're going to probably get there or close to it. But what for many people, I think what they're doing is they might have 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, whatever goals. So you're diluting yourself, your ability, your energy, your focus, your attention, you know, it's a limited resource, and you're splitting it across 10 things, constant context switching, constant, you know, little bit of this, little bit of that, constant distraction, interruption. So therefore you take one step or millimeter forwards in each goal. So you never get to any of them. So I think often the pursuit of lesser goals is another reason people don't get there. And then, you know, you said excuses. And I think, you know, that word straight away for some people, they'll be like, oh, they don't like that word. But I think that the reality is that for a lot of people, if they do make an excuse, if they do, you know, have this barrier or this blocker that stops them achieving or stops them kind of going after their goal, I often look at that and I say, well, you know, what's the excuse? Either you don't want the goal enough. For example, like someone else has given you that goal. Someone else has said, oh, you should really do this, or your parents expect it from you, or your partner wants you to do it, or someone else wants the goal for you. You don't really want it. Or you don't have the confidence in your own ability, or you're afraid, essentially. It's fear and confidence. Fear and confidence. I think those things really, when you get into it and you get underneath, like, what's the reason that you know, said you were going to get up and do this and you didn't do it? Or what's the reason? You know, people can look externally, can't they, and say, oh, you know, the reason is this, the reason is that, you know, my boss is a nightmare, or this happened or that happened. And life does happen. Life does happen. Real problems exist. We live in the real world. But I think often if you get underneath that, there's a fear there, there's a confidence, there's something that's kind of just going, oh, you know, see, now this has happened, I can't do it. And it kind of lets you off the hook, you know?
Number two, you talked about the little stuff getting in the way of the big stuff. So let's say someone has 10 things. They've made a list of 10 things they would like to do more of in approximate order. Like for me, let's say it's starting boxing again and getting my boxing body back to growing a massive podcast. So there's 10 things on there. And it's very easy to maybe like cross out the bottom five. Like you mm-hmm. know that they're the bottom five. So you can kind of, you know, get them out of the way. But then, as you say, then the number 2, 3, 4, 5 can really get in the way of number one. How would you help someone work out what their number one actually is? That, you know, number 2 and 1 are kind of there, and it's a big to drop something that you want to do. It's quite a big deal, isn't it? Like Oliver Berkman, that productivity writer, he said, like, you know, if you to go deep into anything, you need to just do that one thing and be willing to just push through it. Like, how do people find that one thing?
Yeah, again, it's a great question. I think that the way I view it is a hierarchy. So exactly like you're describing is a hierarchy, and people even starting with that, they might not know what the hierarchy is, but if you can start with the hierarchy, that's a great place to start. And then figuring out what that number one thing is and how you're going to pursue it at the cost of everything else. I like to see my life in seasons. And so I just think each season, it has one goal. I don't have two or three goals in any season. I have one goal, because when that season ends, I can move on to the next goal. And I think for a lot of reasons, this has been really helpful for me. So a real practical example is that last year, at the beginning of the year, I said yes to running the London Marathon again. I'm an endurance runner. I enjoy running, but full marathons is, you know, it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge for anyone, but it's a real challenge. It's a real commitment. I have work commitments. I have, you know, kids, stepkids. I have a busy life. I like to travel. And so the idea of training for the marathon for 4 or 5 months in the winter in the UK, it's a big commitment. So because I knew I was doing that, that first start of the year last year is almost like, this is the season for the marathon. So because that's the season, that's the goal, doesn't mean I don't have any other commitments, but it means I know the hierarchy. It is London Marathon. I know the date when it's happening. I know the cost, you know, socially. I know that I'm not going to be drinking alcohol on Saturday night. Like, I know this is marathon season. But after the marathon, when it's summertime, it's a different season. And so I'd say the last, you know, year and a bit has been book writing season. I'm currently writing another book. And it's like, you know, because that is the number one priority in this season. Again, that means that sometimes in the morning right now, I'm just get up and I'm writing first of all. And I might want to go, I'd like to go for a workout this morning, or I'd like to go for a run this morning. No. This is, I've got a word deadline. This is book season. So I think for me, having a season, A, it makes it more motivating, because I'm like, right, eyes on the prize. B, it helps me to, I guess, say no to other things, because it doesn't mean no forever. It means no for this season. And I think having that clarity has really helped me to achieve goals. You know, it's helped me to do multiple things over the last few years. And objectively, people looking in to other people's, you know, lives or works or careers, it might look as though I'm doing everything at the same time. Because often people, you know, you see other people's lives and you just go, oh, you're doing all these things. But actually over the last, say, 10 years, 12 years, you know, I have achieved a fair amount of things, but not at the same time, you know.
When you tick off a goal and you've reached it and you're like, yay, do you give yourself a period of rest after that to kind of just enjoy the fruits of your labour, or are you automatically onto the next thing?
Yeah, you know what? If you'd asked me this a year ago, I probably would have said, I wouldn't have wanted to admit it, but I would have probably, if I'd been honest, I'd be onto the next thing. You know, I think that's kind of part of my personality. But also part of the culture that we live in, you know, achievement culture, part of the pace of the modern world, kind of encouraging us to be like, okay, that was great, what's next? Okay, that was cool, what's bigger, what's better? You know, that's just, it's the environment that we live in promotes and encourages us, not just, you know, it promotes and encourages us to live that way. I'd say I'm trying a lot more intentionally to be like, okay, you've achieved something. Take a moment, take a minute, look at this. And even if you didn't get exactly what you wanted. So again, the marathon's a great example. I ran the marathon for a charity, a London-based charity called The Outrunners. They do amazing work in Hackney for young people. So the purpose of running the marathon was for them. Now your ego is like, what time you're gonna get? How, you know, how's it gonna go? And obviously, because I work in this industry as well, people are like, oh, Adrienne, you're running the marathon, you know, what time you're gonna get? So the ego starts going, okay, I'm gonna get this time and I'm gonna set myself a goal, sub four, you know, that should be able to do that, and I'll put in the training, I'll put in the work. So you know where this is going. So I put in the training and I put in the work and I worked really, really hard. But life happens, right? Life happens. And you know, I had a long haul flight 2 weeks before where I was in my cycle. Things weren't exactly working in my favor on race day, but I was like, you know what, I'm going to show up, I'm going to give it my all, I'm going to do my best. And 26 miles is a long way to run. So I didn't hit my time goal of the sub four. I ran it in 4 hours and 5 minutes. So I was 5 minutes over. And on that day, like I said, the focus really was, you're running this incredible race, which is really, really, you know, it's an achievement in itself to complete a marathon. You're running this to raise money and raise awareness for this incredible charity. Some of the young people from the charity are literally there at mile 21, like, you know, and you're there for them. So don't let your ego ruin this wonderful achievement that you've done by going, yeah, but I didn't get my time. Yeah, but I was 5 minutes. You know, someone asking you, oh, what time did you get? Did you get your sub four? It's like, no, I didn't get it. And I feel like that last year, I felt it for like a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And then I was like, no, I'm not. You know, whereas I think before I would have probably really been like, yeah, it would have bothered me a lot. And I probably would have, to your earlier question around the next thing, thing, I probably would have gone, right, sign up, I'm doing it again. This time I'm going to get my time. But I kind of just went, you know, that it's life, you know, it's what it is. And maybe I'll do a marathon again. But this year was not that season because I was like, I've got to write this book. So I'm trying to, like I said.
Speaking of ego, how do you know when you're setting a goal, if it is coming from a place of, I actually genuinely really want to do this myself, or it's coming from a place of ego and wanting to do what everyone else expects you to do, society, etc.? How do you differentiate between the two? And also, can you give an example of when you have done something which is ego-led and maybe it hasn't got the results you wanted?
Yeah, how do you differentiate? So I guess there's probably, and maybe this is just me, maybe I'm not like zen enough right now, but I feel like there's probably always, do you know what I mean? There's probably always a bit of our ego in there, whether it's not necessarily externally to show to other people, but maybe to prove to ourselves. I think I've always grown up, I'll be honest with you. I used to have a bit of a chip on my shoulder that I wanted to kind of show to people, actually, I am smart, or actually, I can do it. Or, you know, I grew up, you know, I went to school, I grew up with a single mother with a low income household. And I, you know, I went to school, and me and my siblings, I genuinely think the teachers didn't really expect much from us. I don't think like statistically or society expected much from us. And I think I always had a bit of a like, I'll show you about me. You know, I always wanted like to kind of, yeah, I don't know. And I think I've had to, again, learn to like let that go, because you can spend your whole life being like, I'll show you. And who are you really showing? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's that about? But I think, yeah, growing up, I definitely wanted to. Achievement, I think, was a way in which it was quite validating for me to achieve things. And so, yeah, it's a real habit, actually. I think many people, if they're really honest, let's be honest, like I said, society rewards you for achieving things. You get told, well done. You get told, oh, you've smashed it. Oh, you're great. Oh, you're so, I don't know, disciplined or hardworking, or you're so smart. Or you're so brilliant. We do it to our kids, right? I try not to, but we praise the outcome instead of praising the effort.
So true.
So that's something I'm very cognizant of now as a parent, is trying to praise the effort rather than praising the outcome. Yeah. So I think very deeply, as you can probably tell, about these things. And when it comes to like, is this goal driven by my ego, or is this driven by a real sense of value or meaning or purpose? I think the ultimate test is maybe to ask yourself, like, would you do this? Do you still want to do this? Would you do this if no one was watching and no one would ever know?
I love that.
No one would ever know about it. Yeah. You know, like there's certain things that I do as part of my life, part of my daily routine. And I just do them because I want to do them. I enjoy them. And if no one ever knew about it, doesn't matter. Mm. You know, it's like those people who give philanthropy, they give to charity and they give anonymously, versus giving with the look at me.
Yeah, you know those people.
It can work the other way as well, though. Like, as in for me, sometimes I'm like, if everyone knew that I was doing this, would I still do it? It can work that way.
Okay. Oh, right. Yeah.
But yeah. I'd love to, I reckon, I could be wrong, when you were perhaps less known and had less kind of, you know, awareness, that maybe perhaps it was more ego-driven, a sense of wanting some kind of external validation. All of us are the same. Mm. But perhaps now that you've transcended that, but now perhaps rather than looking for external validation, there is now external pressure. Because as you say, like people are like, you're a runner, so you should ace the London Marathon, or you've written the Power Hour, so you should be internally like productive and always having a good day, etc. And it's coming from a different place almost. Is there any truth in that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we all have, like you say, whatever role you do, whether it's in your workplace, whether it's within your family, like whatever role you play, once you play that role, yeah, there comes, I guess, a bit of an expectation from others that's the role, that's the box that you're in. So you have to stay there, but also a bit of expectation, or maybe a lot of expectation from yourself. And I definitely think that I'm someone who holds myself to high standards. I have, you know, high expectations of myself, because I think, how can I ask high expectations of others if I'm not willing to uphold them myself? So I do, you know, I do set the bar pretty high for myself with a lot of things, personal, professional. And so, yeah, I agree. I think that you definitely start to feel there's more pressure when you, I don't want to say the word like more success, but, you know, when the stakes feel higher, like even, for example, as I said, writing another book, it does feel like I'm putting more pressure on myself already. Because the first time around, it's like, you know, writing the book is the achievement, you know, like, you know, you've got a book deal, you're a new author. It's like, I'm like, you know, like I said, I'm almost, again, that chip on the shoulder. I'm always saying to my English teacher at school, I'm like, look at me, I published a book with Penguin, look at me, you know. But then this time around, it's like, okay, we know you can write, and you wrote a book, and it was, you know, quote unquote, commercially, it did well. So now it feels like the bar's there. So the second book, it better be good, you know. And I think about people who've written, you know, incredible books that have sold millions and millions of copies, and they don't write another book for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's nowhere near that level, but I actually interviewed an author recently who he wrote The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg, like 12 years ago. And he's just written his second book, and it's 12 years between the books. And I remember thinking, I bet I can understand why, because there must be so much pressure. If your first book sells 50 million copies internationally around the world, that second book, people are, you know, it's got to be good. Yeah. So yeah, I think we probably all do that, don't we? Whatever role you're in life and every age and stage, if you get become more capable, more competent and more quote unquote successful at anything, then I suppose there is, yeah, external pressure, mm-hmm. which I guess, like you said, feeds into the ego of like, I'm now at a certain, I don't know, level that I've got to maintain. But I'm not sure if there's any useful advice in that answer, other than just honest anecdotal.
Can we talk about the Power Hour? Because you've written a book called The Power Hour. You have a podcast called Power Hour, which has 4 million downloads, which is incredible. So where did it start? How was it birthed? The Power Hour.
Well, yeah. So I guess I should take you right back if we're going to get into it. But yeah, so like many things in life, I suppose, you know, when we go through challenges, something good can come out of it the other side. And at the time, it doesn't feel like that, does it? You know, at the time, you're like, this is awful. But essentially, I had had some very challenging a couple of years in my life. I was about, how was I? I was early 20s. I was pregnant with my son. I was living my life happy. Things were going well. And I was just, you know, living life. I was newly wed at the time. And my now ex-husband, he was a healthy young guy. And then one night, out of nowhere, suddenly, just like that, he had a spontaneous brain hemorrhage. And this was whilst I was laying next to him in bed, pregnant, and essentially he had seizures, and we went to hospital. And yeah, he was there for 2 weeks in a neurology ward, where my whole life basically changed in those 2 weeks, because I sat there, as you can imagine, sat there, I was actually in my pajamas, because we went straight in the ambulance, and I sat there in my pajamas, pregnant with my first child. My husband was basically, you know, they were saying, oh, he's lucky to be alive. We don't know what's caused this. They essentially, with a burst blood vessel in the brain. So I, at the time, some people might know this, some people might not. At the time, I was performing in a musical in the West End. So I was a professional dancer in a show called We Will Rock You, Queen musical.
Oh my God, I love that show.
The Queen musical and the Dominion Theatre on Tottenham Court Road. And I walked out of the show that night and literally said to the cast, see you tomorrow. Legged it and got on the central line. And I never went back, because that next day when that happened, obviously, you know, my whole life changed. And as I say, moving on from that, you know, it was just a difficult time. Like, things were very challenging. You know, he couldn't work for 6 months whilst he was recovering. We had our first child, which, as you know, is a big change. Everything was kind of just like the rug was really pulled from underneath my feet, and I was very young. And I remember, like, throughout the next couple of months and years, just being a bit like, just a bit mind blown, really, and thinking like, what just happened, but also what could happen next? Mm. I remember just living with this real kind of sense, a little bit of anxiety, but also of urgency. I felt this real, as much as it sounds cliche, just this real like overwhelming, just appreciation, just thinking, oh my gosh, like, it's not good enough to just live. We have to, like, to just be alive. You know, we have to actually live life. You can't just exist. You can't just go to work, you know, go home, watch TV. I was like, anything could happen. Like, the fact that they kept telling us, oh, he's lucky to be alive. You know, essentially, a lot of people, unfortunately, if you have a spontaneous brain hemorrhage, for a lot of people, it's fatal, just there and then, that's it. So the fact that he survived it, I was like, we've got to live our life. We've got to do things. We've got to, like, go and see places that we've never been to. We've got to challenge. I'd never run. I was not a runner then. Like I said, I was a dancer. I'd never run more than, I don't know, the sports day, 100-meter sprint at school. I'm Jamaican. I'd never run. So the idea of running a marathon was like, no way. But I just, yeah, I got this insatiable kind of fire in my belly that was like, I have got to live. Like, not just I, but like we. And I suppose that kind of started a little bit of even the work that I do now, was around like just feeling like I wanted to just kind of shake people by the shoulders and just like encourage them and be like, what do you want to do in this life? Keep living it now. We have all got this one wonderful opportunity, this one wonderful life. And so many of us, sadly, I think, we put things off. Tomorrow stays tomorrow. When I'm older, I'm going to do that. When my kids are older, I'll do that. When I've lost weight, I'm going to do that. If I've more money, then I'm going to do that. If, when, but you know what? You could just be gone. And it sounds so kind of like, wow, okay, it's a bit dark, but it just changed me. It really changed me. And I think from that year onwards, when I started, you know, I started listening to podcasts, and this is years ago, people didn't even know what podcasts were. And I thought, I want to do something like this. I want to, you know, have conversations with interesting people, wonderful people and siphon their knowledge and their wisdom and figure out what motivates them to get out of bed every day. Why do people, when they wake up in the morning, what motivates them to get out of bed? What are they trying to achieve? How do they keep going? And even when things are bad as well, you know, there were times, as you can imagine, after that happened, there were times where I was like low. And I'm talking, you know, just day to day, just getting through the day was like a challenge. And I remember thinking, yeah, what motivates people to carry on when they endure unthinkable things, loss, grief, failure, like what keeps people going? So the power hour, essentially, long story, is about the first hour of the day. It's about what if, radical idea, what if before we gave our energy and our attention and our ideas and before we went into our phones, into our work, before we did that, what if we spent the first hour of every day focusing on ourselves, focusing on our goals, focusing on our health, focusing on what fills you up, what brings you joy, what do you want to do with your life or with your day or with 1 hour? So I had to kind of strip it back, because you can't measure a life. You can't say to someone like, what are you going to do with your life? Or what are you going to do this year or this month or this week or today? Can you just do 1 hour? And that's how it started, really.
And what did you do in that hour initially? Wow. How did you use that hour in those first years?
First years, I used it to walk or run, and I used it for solitude, because as a new mum, I was obviously baby there all the time. But then also, like I said, my ex-husband being unwell, I felt like I was kind of trying to take care of both of them, mm-hmm. Which willingly, of course, gladly, but I felt very claustrophobic. You know, I felt like I was just in the house all day. It felt very like claustrophobic, and I feel like the running in the morning was like, it was solitude. And I think for so many of us, we don't get solitude. You know, we're with our partners, with our kids, with our work, with our phones. Like, being with your phone is not solitude, you know. Mm-hmm. So it gave me solitude. I'd always go early, and the street's pretty empty, it's pretty quiet, it's like a quietness that, for someone like me, I don't have a lot of quiet in my life. Probably doesn't surprise you, but you know, I'm usually pretty quick and busy and fast, and so the idea of, yeah, just going out in the morning when there's no one out on the streets and it's kind of dark and it starts to get bright and you kind of come back to your front door and whatever else happens that day you're like, I did something this morning. And all sorts of things would happen on that run. I mean, you probably know, like, if you do a morning meditation or a morning, anything can happen. That, you know, anything can happen. You can think about something new. Oh, I've got a new idea. Or I started to become more creative, I just started to wonder, actually, how did I used to just get up and not have an hour to do this kind of thing? When do people do thinking and ideation? And when do you do that otherwise?
So what was the cost to that first hour? So I'm thinking, for me now, if I wanted to spend the first hour of the day doing something for me, number one, it would mean, because I prioritize sleep, it would mean going to bed at kind of 9 o'clock or earlier. It would mean either not giving my son morning cuddles, which for me is the best time of the day, or it would mean getting up an hour before he has morning cuddles, which is like, again, like 5:30 or earlier. So what for you went, like what had to go in order to make that happen for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's definitely changed a lot, again, seasons. But I think back then it was definitely, prioritizing sleep. So I'd go to bed early. And what cost for me then, I remember thinking, what am I giving up if I go to bed an hour earlier? I was like, Adrienne, be honest with yourself. What are you actually giving up in the last hour before you go to bed? And this shows you how long ago it was. It was 13 years ago. And at the time I had a blog. So I was like, I'm writing my blog in the evening. It's like, no, you're not. You're just on your laptop looking at ASOS, looking at Twitter. That's what I was doing. That's honestly, I remember writing that down once in like a journal. I was like, you're looking at ASOS, you're looking at Twitter. You are probably, if my husband was watching a net, I don't really watch a lot of TV, so it wasn't that. But if he was watching something, I was faffing about, I was doing stuff. And so then I was like, well, actually, is that hour, for example, to go to bed an hour earlier, is that serving you? Is it, you know, taking you closer towards an end goal? Is it making your life, is it enriching your life? Is it making you happier or healthier? The reality is, was no. So I thought, okay, that's one thing I can do. So I can go to bed an hour earlier. So I started going to bed at 9:45 or 9:30, which I know for most people, they're like, I'm out having dinner at that time. But for me, I was like, I'm going to bed. And that was it, really. I think the first, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because for some people, and like even now, there's days when I'm like, it requires discipline now for me to do it. But back then, it really didn't. It didn't feel like a chore or a task. That's the difference, isn't it? When you set a goal that you want, it feels like a gift to yourself. You're like, oh my gosh, I would tiptoe out of the house, like, don't wake up the baby. And, you know, Jude was probably like one. So I was like, tiptoe out, don't wake him up. And it felt like a gift to myself. I was like, oh yes, this is my hour. This is it. As opposed to being like alarms going off, this punishment, you've got to get your ass out of bed. And some people are like, oh, it sounds like punishment. So it really depends. Like I said, if it's your goal and you want to do it, it's very different. And I think when I've spoken over the years now to people about the power hour since writing the book, you know, sometimes I say to people, like, maybe you don't have to do the power hour every day. Maybe there's one day a week where you have your power hour, and maybe your partner knows, or your kids know, and maybe that's your 1 hour a week where you take your coffee in the garden, you read your book, or you go for a walk. And people are like, oh, actually, yeah, like, maybe I can, because then it does feel like a gift. It does feel like something to look forward to, something to enjoy. And the night before, go to bed early. So yeah, it definitely changes. And like I said, now I've got a different setup with stepkids and kids, and they're older, so it's different. But back then, that's how it worked.
So an extension of like the power hour is, I guess, the view to create a life that is on your terms. Yeah. And I'd love to talk about that as an idea, because I'm all for it, but I want to play devil's advocate for a second. I'm noticing, like, in the modern world, again, I sound like a middle-aged old man now, like the younger generation.
Nearly there.
Yeah, is perhaps they are focusing a little bit more on themselves, but there is a point in which perhaps this idea of creating a life completely on your own terms can lead to a certain selfishness and a willing to not compromise. And that can affect many things. It can affect relationships, and people aren't willing to be with a partner unless they are this perfect doting person that lets them do everything they want. And whether you're having children, whether you want an ideal career, whether you're building a business, whether you want a life partner, lots of compromises have to be made. And that is part of going deep in anything. And if it's always on your terms, then you'll never have the privilege of going deep, which then, you know, if you don't end up with a partner you want to be with, then suddenly that time's gone. And then potentially, if you leave it too late, then you don't have kids. If you did want kids in the first place, everything gets pushed back a little bit. So I guess, could you talk about how people might navigate the idea of life on your own terms and then being selfish? Because the idea of life on your own terms probably wouldn't have existed to our parents, certainly not to our grandparents. Mm. So if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really great framing in that way. And I think I completely agree, firstly of all, with what you said around compromise, especially when it comes to, you know, creating a family and relationships. And that's to me what relationship is. You know, it's both of you being on the same team. It's kind of, you know, your win is my win, what you need, I need. If you have a problem, I have a problem. Like, that's how I see, you know, relationship. And so I definitely agree on that, in the sense that it's not at the expense of all and everyone else. It's not kind of like create exactly what you want, how you want. It has to work for you, and everyone else has to kind of just, you know, fall in line. I think it's much more about, when I say create a life on your own terms, I think what I mean is a life that is not going to kind of got the constraints of what is expected. Like, as we know historically, maybe even when we were at school, around like, you have to do this thing and go this path and get married and have kids and have a house and have a mortgage and do this and do this and do this and pay your taxes and die. Like, that's what I mean. Do you know what I mean? That's what I mean by your own terms. It's like, how do you want to live? Why? What, you know? But I think, I guess, on a more practical level, I have had people say to me in the past, look, I really want to do this, whether it's power hour or something completely different, but my partner is in a real kind of different place right now, or they're kind of a handbrake, or they can feel like they're not supporting me, or actually they kind of pull me back to those other habits. Let's say, you know, at the beginning you talked about goals, and someone said, I had a client years ago when I used to do a lot of one-to-one coaching, and she always drank a lot of alcohol. She'd always drank a lot of alcohol. She kind of had like a family culture of drinking, but she was like, I want to change this. And, you know, she's getting older and it was impacting her health, etc. So she would say, right, I'm not going to drink alcohol, you know, Monday to Thursday, for example, and I'll just drink at the weekend. But then her husband would kind of roll his eyes and say, oh, for goodness sake, don't be so silly, and pour her a glass of wine. Mm. So if you've got that person there going, oh, come on, or, you know, the person going, oh, you're doing that gym thing again, or that person going, oh, you know, live a little, spend your money, whatever it is, it's hard. It makes it harder, actually, when you've not got that person kind of in your corner, kind of helping and supporting you. So I've heard that many times. And I think my advice is always the same. It's kind of, you've got to have honest communication and express and tell them how important this is to you. You know, how important this goal is to you, or this choice is to you, and that you actually need. Sometimes people don't know as well, you know, unless we tell them. We think they can read our minds. But I think sometimes spelling out to someone and saying, look, this is really important to me. It's going to be hard for me anyway. You know, I really want to try my best. I'm really going to go for this. And I really need you to support me. I need you to help me. I need you to ask for what you want as well. Ask for what you need. So, for example, If I said to my husband, I'm signing up for another marathon, and it was a winter one, he'd probably look at me like I'd lost my mind. But if I said to him, listen, I want you to make sure I do not miss a run. It doesn't matter if it's raining. It doesn't matter if it's cold. That is what I'm asking of you. Then on that day, when I want to miss it, it's not his job to go, oh, come and stay in bed. Oh, babe, you know, I'll make you a coffee. Oh, it's his job to go get out the door, you know, like, because that's what I've asked for. So it's kind of, I think, you know, being willing to ask for what you want and what you need, but then being willing to accept it. And let's be honest, it's not always going to work. Life's not perfect. Sometimes people aren't going to be able to do that. So yeah, it's a challenge. I think there's compromise. I think conversation, you know, asking for what you need, and especially women, because I'll be honest, Adam, when you said the word selfish, I was a bit like, oh, because I feel like a lot of women, I feel like a lot of women have this feeling. They'll say to me like, oh, it feels really self-indulgent or really selfish. I feel really guilty if I go and do X, Y, and Z because of the mum guilt or the mother load, or they feel this feeling of like, they're kind of, even just growing up as a woman. A good example is, you know, you know, in America, they have like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts. I think we have a similar thing here, like brownies, whatever. So in America, they have like the rules of conduct for the Boy Scouts. And the first one, so there's probably like 10. Number one is to be a leader. Okay. Be a leader, lead others. What do you think the number one rule is for the girls?
Be a follower.
Imagine. Any other guesses? What do you think?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. Mind blank.
Look after some.
Very close.
Look after, nurture, rule, something about nurturing.
Rule is, I will always put others before myself.
Oh, okay.
It's the idea of doing things in service of others is the most valuable thing you can do. And if you have, just because of the world, as a woman, as a young girl, as a young woman, been taught and told and rewarded for doing acts of service to others, that doesn't mean you should never do them. You know, like I said, as a mother, as a sister, as a friend, as a wife, I love doing things for other people. I do it gladly. But it doesn't mean doing things, acts of service of others, at the exclusion, at the cost of yourself. And I think that's where this word selfish and self-care and self-love, and it's just become like, oh, the self, everyone's self-obsessed, they're all obsessed with themselves. But the reality is, like, that fine line between, actually, is it okay for me to have an hour to myself in the morning? Is that, you know, I think it's really, yeah, it's a challenging one, which I don't know, I want to kind of say to people, look at the rest of your day, look at the other 23 hours, because you're probably giving a lot to a lot of other people.
And you're just so much better when you give that hour to yourself as well. Like, you know, even a minute, even 1 minute of just no one around me and just closing my eyes, just, it just fills you up, and you can give so much more when you are giving that to yourself.
To speak to men slightly there as well, though, I think especially perhaps with the more modern man who wants to be like an active parent and the like, there's always been a sense of duty. Ingrained in men, like, you have to look after people. It's your duty to
provide
and provide, etc., etc. And I think now lots of kind of modern men feel the duty to be everything, that to be the provider, the person that keeps the family safe, as it were, the reliable one, but also the amazing dad, the emotional person as well. They feel the duty to perhaps to be everything. And I think perhaps, you know, that's why, not why, the only reason why, but, you know, male suicide is so high. The biggest pillar of men of my age, because there is this overwhelm of duty, and they're not there. So there, it's not about necessarily not wanting to be selfish, but in a sense, they feel that they shouldn't. They are the last thing on the ladder to look after. Everything else should be looked after before they are.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. And I think you're familiar with it. Esther Perel, of course, no. right? And her and no. her work. No. Oh gosh, you love. So Esther Perel is this incredible, incredible psychotherapist and relationship therapist, and she talks a lot about kind of, I just think, obviously relationships, but also the context in which we live now. And she talks a lot about the fact that we used to live obviously in communities, and we'd get different things from different people within that community. So that might be, you know, you lived close to parents, maybe they'd helped with childcare, you might have friends or family. It just was different, right? We lived in the, you know, that whole it takes a village. And now typically we don't live in those ways anymore. So the one person that we're with, to your point, Adam, it's like we want that person to be everything. It's like you have to be a friend, you have to be a business partner, you have to be good bed, you have to be a good dad, you have to be nurturing, you have to be there. You want the person to, and again, people's expectations of, you know, comparison, and well, this person's doing it like this, and this person's got that great body, and you want this one person to be everything, and it's a lot of pressure, and it's not realistic. It's not realistic. And so I think hearing that, you know, as you described then around the different roles in which the modern man is trying to fulfill, and you know, it's a lot. I think that maybe it's partly to do with actually, yeah, the way we all live now, and the lack of community, and the lack of support, and the fact that we often do feel this kind of individual approach to life, which is that it's all on you. It's all on you, the individual, as opposed to going, this is a shared responsibility. You know, like often when people get married, they talk about the community of people there that are going to support and help and nurture, and they say it, but then what happens after? You know, who's the community of people that help you to raise your children, or that help you to nurture your marriage together and have time to go out without the kid? You know, there's a lot of things. I think it's different podcast.
Do you think the problem is almost like self-circulating as well, in that we've been told it's with the lack of support, it becomes all on us. Then at the same time, some people are telling us it's all about us. They say it's all about you, and you should do what you want to do. And it becomes like a little circle. It falls on you, then it becomes about you, and then
also I think I can probably relate a lot to that, in the sense that you almost, like you said, it's fulfilling itself, because essentially you become, okay, I need to be capable, I need to be competent, I need to be ambitious, I need to be driven, I need to achieve. So you do that. And then because you've done it, as you said, people's expectation is, oh, Adrienne, you're good. You don't need help. You don't need anyone to help and support and encourage and do the practical, because you've got this. You can do it all. You're doing it all. And so you kind of fulfill that thing. You're like, why is no one helping me? You're like, because you made it look like you don't need any help, and you haven't asked for any help.
Can we move a little bit to productivity?
Yeah. Now,
so I guess the thing with productivity isn't an end in itself. Like if you try and be productive at work, what it often ends up meaning is you work faster. And if work is infinite, you will just keep working. You will just get through more work. And you'll never, like productivity should be a way, or efficiency should be a way to actually live a life you want and find more time to do the things you want to do. So what does productivity look like kind of in your world, in your headspace?
Yes. So productivity, the way I guess I try to measure it, is essentially, it used to be, didn't it, to produce an outcome. And as you said, if you don't define what that outcome, what that product is, or that production is, that you're trying to be productive to produce a set amount, you're just going to keep doing more and more and more and more, and it will never end. So for me, it's again, having like parameters and having measure. I'm such a like data person, honestly, like I'm data mad in life. Everything's measured. If it's not measured, what are we doing? So I mean, basically, I feel like everything for me is measurable. It's got timelines. It's got deadlines. It's got, you know, it's got an end. It's got a finish line, has an end goal. So therefore, it doesn't. I think it kind of, that way I can avoid that kind of next, because there can always be more, and there can always be bigger, and there can always be better. But also, do you want more? Does bigger mean better? Like I have this whole thing I always say, which is like, you don't need more than more. And so say for example, if you're a freelancer, if you're an entrepreneur, like everyone knows that opportunities come and you're like, oh, that's a good opportunity, I should do it. And like sometimes when it comes to even income, people are like, oh, and they just work and work and work and work and work and work and work, and they never take a break, and they never seem to switch off or take time off. But it's essentially, if you don't know what your goal is, you don't know if you've achieved it, you don't know if you've passed it, so you just keep going. So I think I got to a point a few years ago where I was like, okay, and unfortunately so, I know I'm in a very privileged position to be able to say that, but I got to a point where I was like, okay, this is great, this is good. Like you know, surpassed what I ever thought and could have dreamt of, honestly, of achieving or doing or whatever. And I was like, you don't need more than more. If you've got more, like I feel, honestly, I feel so abundant and so grateful. I feel like obviously my house, like I don't live in a mansion, I'm not a millionaire, but I feel like I am because I'm like, I love my kitchen. I love the tree in my garden. I love like my home, you know, I love that. And I didn't feel that, you know, growing up at all. You know, like I say, it was challenging and I didn't even have a garden. I didn't have a garden until I was maybe in my 30s. And I actually like, I treasure it. I savor things. I really savor things. And so I'm like, you don't need more. I don't need a bigger garden. I don't need a bigger house. I don't need more than more because I'm just like, wow, like I have this. And I think if, for example, you, and I'm guilty of this, I'm not trying to make out that I haven't made these mistakes in the past, but if you're so busy with working and achieving and doing and training and thinking, then you can't enjoy the things. And we know it's cliche. We know we hear it, but how many people do we know that are exhausted, burnt out, stressed, like they can't even enjoy the thing they've worked their absolute ass off to get because they're exhausted and they're burnt out and they're literally like, you know, look like they're a corpse and everyone's going, you smashed it, you're killing it. It's like, is this what smashing it looks like? And like I said, I'm not exempt from that myself. I've definitely had those weeks where I've been so overwhelmed and so many things going on and I'm spinning plates and I've got to be here and there and doing everything. And you're like, wow, this week was a blur. As opposed to being like, you know, so yeah, I don't, like I said, don't have all the answers. I'm certainly not a Zen master as I would probably aspire to be, and maybe some of your listeners are. But yeah, it's a challenge.
Can we talk about motivation? Because I read somewhere that you talked about how motivation is something that just comes and goes. Do you feel that you always need to be motivated, or do you allow yourself those periods of time where you are not motivated and kind of lean into it? And I guess actually from my perspective, I've just come out my first trimester. I've never been less motivated to do anything, including walking up the stairs in my life.
It took literally about 10 minutes of her like sitting on the stairs on the way up in like an attic. And I kept kind of like kicking.
Everything is such an effort. But now I'm kind of fearing, you know, I'm moving into my second trimester. And I'm thinking, have I got into the habit now of being unmotivated? Mm. And do you wait for motivation to strike before you take inspired action? Or do you kind of have to give yourself a bit of a kick up the arse sometimes and ignite it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. For me, I'll be really honest, I probably feel motivated to do the things that I need to do a third of the time. At best. I say 30% of the time. So 30% of the time I feel motivated. I feel like I can do it all. I'm just like, yes, give it to me. I'd say a third of the time I feel probably like I know the benefit of it. I know the reason why I set the goal. I know why I want to, you know, I understand cognitively, okay, I've got to do this. And once I get started, it won't be that bad. And then a third of the time, I'm just like, I do not want to do this. I would rather do anything else but do this. I'm going to procrastinate. I'm going to complain about this. And that's, I kind of accept that. And actually one of the things that I think I've kind of revoked, you know, when you put things out into the world and then like a few years later, you're like, change my mind. And I kind of say to people, it's okay to change your mind.
Yeah.
So one thing I used to talk a lot about was consistency. And I used to be a bit like, you know what? We've got to be consistent because what we do sometimes doesn't really matter, right? But what we do most of the time is what's going to make the difference. And there is some truth in that. But I think it kind of goes against human nature to be consistent. And I actually learned this from a psychologist, and I was listening to her. I was interviewing her and I was like, oh my gosh, because I was like, I'm wrong. I've been saying this for years. I'm wrong. But it was this idea that actually, yeah, we are inconsistent. Life is inconsistent. Seasons, like I said before, we have seasons. And like right now you're in a season. So I think when it comes to motivation, for me, there are things that are non-negotiable. And if you create some non-negotiables for yourself when you're in a good headspace, when you almost like you think about, you know, think of like a friend, what would a friend do for you? What would a friend say for you? Like if you're in a good place for yourself and you love and you want the best for yourself and you're like, come on, this is going to be good for us. You know, it's going to be good. If you set the non-negotiables then you just kind of have to stick to them, motivated or not. Like there's days when you're like, you're not motivated. And so instead you have to be disciplined and you have to do the non-negotiable because you set it for yourself for a reason. Going back to what I said before around, it's not a punishment. It's not a punishment for you to do this. You set this goal for yourself. So I think, you know, motivation, I just think, yeah, you can't rely on it. It's never going to be there on the day when you plan to, like, for example, again, with a schedule with kids and work and things, I might have a day planned out, which is like, I've got 7 hours today of writing, no distractions, and that day I'm not motivated and I want to do anything else. But then 3 days later, when I'm feeling really motivated, it's not a writing day. It's a podcast day, it's a football day, it's all these other things day. So sometimes I think when you do feel the motivation, oh my gosh, you've got to notice it and acknowledge it and be like, this is it, it's gold dust, it's going to be, you know, it's like the kind of spark, the flame bit. It's not going to last for long, it's going to blow out. So just use that energy. But then when it's not there, of course there'll be exceptions, there'll be days when it's like, you know, you don't want to berate yourself into doing things. But I think sometimes the action, like you said about action first, I think sometimes the action comes first. It can be a small action. Like for me, it's sometimes if I'm in that like low energy, it's music. It's like, I don't want to dance around and feel upbeat, so I put music on. It's the other way around. I play the music to lift, and then I want to dance around. Then I want to feel, then I want to match that energy.
It's like discipline is, I think, more important, isn't it, to some degree. So forget, I guess, consistency, but discipline is more important than motivation. And I guess you need motivation to do the macro things, the big projects, but you need discipline to do the little things, the little wins. And often, well, in my experience, the discipline to like get to the gym, or the discipline to actually just do those emails I've been sitting in my inbox for a while, creates then the motivation to do the next thing. And I always find that. And I love that the writer Neil Gaiman, he used to say that he would never rely on being motivated to write. The non-negotiable was that he would go in his shed where he wrote, sit there for 2 hours, and he could do two things. He could sit there, or he could write. And soon enough, he started writing interesting stuff. And that was just his everyday commitment, just 2 hours of sitting there. No, we should actually move on to little quick fires now.
Okay.
So one little quick fire is, if you had more time, or when you have free time, what would you want to do more of?
I love this because I used to ask other people this. What would I do? Okay, if I have more time right now, where I'm at right now, if I had more time, I would spend that time, I'd spend it face to face with friends. I miss my friends, you know. We send voice notes and pictures and all that, but I'd spend my time with my friends in my house or in their house.
No pubs or bars.
Pardon?
No pubs or bars. You'd rather be in their house.
I'd rather be in my house. I'd rather be in their house. I'd rather,
If you could be in another show in the West End, what would it be?
Ooh, that's a good question. I guess I've probably got to say Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
He's a genius, isn't he? He's an absolute genius.
Oh my gosh. And I know every single word.
How many times have you seen it?
Every single word. Well, I've only actually seen it. I've seen it a few times because I had a friend who was in the cast, so I've seen it a few times. But more like, I've listened to obviously the soundtrack, like we all have. But the kids are always so impressed because they're like, "How can you rap that fast?" I'm like, "I know every word and the harmonies."
Love it.
Yeah, he did it on Jonathan Roth, didn't he? What's his name again?
It's Lin-Manuel.
Yeah, he did it on Jonathan Roth. They just said, "Oh, can you do a little the intro?" And he did like a minute, like, and he just covered everything. It was, oh my God, it was amazing. And anything you would like to leave our listeners with in terms of, let's say the quick question, how would you get rid of decision fatigue?
How would you get rid of decision fatigue?
Or what would you manage that? How would you manage that?
You said this is quick fire.
You know, that's boring. Forget that question. Give us some motivation.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, put me on the spot here, but here we go. I feel like what would motivate me right now is to remember that the time is going to pass, the next week, the next month, the next year, the next 10 years, whether we do the thing or not, whether we pursue the goal or not. So, for example, I met a friend a few years ago at the school gate, and she said that she wanted to retrain to do a new career, completely new career. She wanted to go back to university. She was always a it's a 4-year degree. And if I said to you now, we're going to start something today, it's going to take you 4 years. Just like training for the Olympics, right? It's 4 years. Who's motivated for that goal when it's in 4 years? Nobody. But that time's going to pass whether you do or not. So she did it. And I didn't really, you know, she's not a close friend, but I'd see her every now and again. And soon enough, you know, the kids were probably, I don't know, 4, 5, 6. Now they're 12. So I remember seeing her when she was like, yeah, I've finished it. You know, now I've got the, she's got a completely new career. She retrained. She did the thing. She could still be one of those people telling me, oh, I really want to retrain. And one day, you know, I'm going to do it. One day when the kids are older, you know that. But she's done it. She's done it 4 years ago. So the time will pass, whether we pursue our goals or not, whether we spend that time, whatever we choose to spend that time on, it will pass. And it's not about maximize every minute of every day and optimize. No, that's not a life well lived. But I do think that we've got to become more intentional and more aware of how we spend our time, because as much as, like I said, it's not about optimizing every minute, but it is a limited resource. We're not getting it back. We're not getting any more of it. You know, that's it. So as I hope it's motivating to say to people, don't put off the thing, whatever it is, just start. Start with 1 hour, start with 10 minutes, start by just telling someone, start by just, you know, writing it down, start, take action, do action. Inaction is your greatest risk in life.
Oh, I love that.
Amazing. Love that. Thank you so much. That was so inspiring.
It was. Can I share right? something from Seneca? And he said that we act like mortals in all we fear and immortals in all we desire. And I think that last bit, particularly in terms of what you just said, like we act like we've got all the time in the world. We want to do that thing. And yeah, next year, another year, I'll do it at some point when time is right. And then suddenly we're dead. But yeah, that's a really wonderful sentiment to leave on. And what do you want people to know about you and where to find you and podcasts and a book? Is books not been announced yet formally?
No, I know it hasn't. I don't know. I'm sure I'm allowed. I don't know if I'm allowed, but I'm...
There is a book.
Plug it.
There is a book. It's not going to be out for a while, but I'd say the Power Hour podcast is out every week. I'd say the Power Hour book is, you know, available everywhere. And if you felt motivated to take action from this conversation, then I really think there's something in the book for everyone, you know, to kind of take away and go, aha, this can be my accountability to hopefully start creating a life that you love just with 1 hour.
And it's got amazing reviews. I did a lot of stalking. You're like on like a 4.7 on Amazon with like a lot of reviews. Ooh, like you're
is
doing.
Is that good? I mean, yeah. it's hard because I feel like it's so hard to compare. Like I said, I've only written one book, so I don't know. But you go on Amazon and maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I'm just like, oh, your book's this tiny little book. You know, you look at, I think when it came out, it went up the charts for a while because obviously when it comes out, it's an algorithm or whatever. And for a few days, it was like next to Barack Obama's book.
Amazing.
I remember being like, oh my God. But then you look at Barack Obama's book and it'll probably have like 10 million reviews and yours has got like 400. So thank you for saying that, because I think no matter what we do, like you said, that comparison thing, we're always going to look at the person who's, I don't know, the James Clear or the whoever else and think that, oh, my little book. But I should be proud of it.
And actually, I don't know, you might not check yourself, but so many people have said how much it's changed their week. And they've been doing it for a week and it's completely changed their week, or it's been changed. Yeah, I think it's probably worth stalking yourself occasionally and like seeing the reviews. I'm sure you, I don't know if you get this or not, but I get it with podcasts that I forget that people actually listen to it. And when someone says, oh, actually that episode really touched me and it made me do this. And I'm sure it's the same with the book, but like exponential. That you've probably touched so many lives of that book and you've got no idea. So it's nice, I guess, occasionally to have a little stalk around. And you're even featured on, do you know Blinkist? Have you come across Blinkist?
Yes.
Yeah, you're on that. I don't know if you know you're on that. Which is,
I don't know if I knew that I'm on that, but I think, because is everyone on that? Or does it?
No, because that requires someone to actively like summarize your book and do an audio book about it. Yeah, so that.
Oh, wow. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, you're definitely on that. But thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Honestly, I'm balanced.